Hi, welcome to the Behind the Balance Sheet podcast, where we meet leading investors and commentators and educate ourselves about the world of investing and the world. Our mission is to remove some of the mystique around investing and improve our understanding of what makes a successful investment, or indeed an unsuccessful one. Our goal is to inform, educate, and entertain. We hope you enjoy this and every episode.
Behind the Balance Sheet and affiliates and podcast guests may own shares or have an economic interest in securities discussed in this podcast, which is aired for your education and entertainment only. Nothing in this podcast should be construed as investment advice or relied upon for investment decisions. Always do your own research.
Edmund Smithfield is a top financial communications firm and a recognized market leader in reputation management and profile raising for financial services companies. They work with some of the biggest names in the investment world, and every 2 years, they release their Asset Management Brand Index. This is a quantitative ranking of the strongest brands among the 50 largest global asset managers, based on input by major investment consultants and allocators. They also have a ranking of the 40 largest wholesale asset managers in the UK, based on input by IFAs and wealth managers. This is impressive IP, which helps asset managers determine the levers they can pull to improve their brands. A key trend in the 2024 Asset Management Brand Index is what Edmund Smithfield are calling the Great Amorphization, where allocators increasingly see asset management as a homogenized industry and where it is ever more difficult to stand out. Visit edmundsmithfield.com from February 26th to learn more. This month of the show is one of my heroes. Bill Browder has dedicated his life to the memory of his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, killed in a Russian prison. This is a noble endeavor and one taken at considerable personal risk. I wouldn't have been that brave. Bill jokes that he was the dunce of his family, but his achievements are amazing. 1 year, his was the best performing hedge fund in the world. He's written not one, but two best-selling books, and he's been the driving force behind legislation in over 30 countries to sanction thugs and crooks. In this episode, we talk about his career, about how he coped with a 90% fall in the value of his fund, about how he subsequently engineered a 37 times recovery for the portfolio, about his deportation from Russia, and how he subsequently secretly cashed in the gains and returned that cash to investors. And of course, we talk about the events that led up to the tragic death of his lawyer and friend, Sergei Magnitsky. If you haven't read Bill's two books, Red Notice and Freezing Order, they are brilliant and they tell this story in much greater detail. But this discussion is wonderful. I so enjoyed having a chance to hear this almost unbelievable tale at first hand. This is Bill's story and the views expressed here are Bill's. And if you're not familiar with that story, I warn you, it's shocking. You're going to enjoy and be enthralled at this discussion. Bill, thank you so much for coming on. I'm really excited. I always say that I'm really excited, but this time I'm really, really excited to speak to you because I've really so enjoyed your two books. You're very unusual because you've had incredible success in three different careers as an investor, a best-selling author, and now as a human rights activist. And you also have a very unusual background. Your grandfather ran for president twice in a communist ticket. Your mother was from a very poor background. And your father was a mathematician who went to MIT age 16 and a PhD from Princeton by the time he was 20. And your brother is one of the world's top particle physicists, which is quite an amazing background. I was very curious about what gave you the fortitude to embrace this campaign and to go up against Putin. And in Freezing Order, you tell us the story of the loss of your flute as a kid. And I thought that gave some insight into why you do this. Would you like to just tell that story?
Well, let me just back up for a second. So I was the dumb one in my family. We had all these child prodigies. My father, I actually have two uncles who are also mathematicians. My brother, as you mentioned, is a top particle physicist. And so, and perhaps it was really fortuitous that I was not the genius of all these other people, because that sent me in a different direction than everybody else in my family. But to come to the flute, so my uncle Bill, he played the flute. And when I was very little, like, I don't know, 8 or 9, he gave me one of his old flutes, which was a sterling silver flute. And it was really nice. It was, I mean, I don't know how valuable it was. It seemed really valuable to me because it was made of silver.
Sure.
And so I dutifully took up the flute, and I was really not a great musician. And so I was the last flutist in the school orchestra, but I kind of kept at it. And I lived in the south side of Chicago in Hyde Park near the University of Chicago, which at the time was, and actually still is, surrounded by 3 ghettos in the lake. And basically at the time, if you crossed over 47th Street, you would die. Literally. I mean, it's like the, you know, the demilitarized zone or whatever. You crossed over 63rd Street, you would die. You crossed over Cottage Grove on the west, you would die. And then the other side was a lake. But the way that the university kept everybody safe was by having more university police per capita than any neighborhood or any community in the United States. And on every other street corner, there was a white phone. And if you got into trouble, if anyone was causing trouble, you go to the phone, pick up the phone, and within 30 seconds, a university police car was there. And so my parents felt comfortable letting me be a kid in the neighborhood. And I walked to school on my own. And I walked to school with my flute to play in the orchestra. And one day, as I was walking, these 3 boys who were older than me, maybe 15, approached me, and one of them said, "I want to see what you got." And I said, "No." One of them grabbed my flute. One of them grabbed me, and I was struggling with them, and they grabbed the flute, and the 3 of them ran off. And I was very shaken. I ran, of course, to the nearest white police phone, picked up the phone, and within 30 seconds, the university police were there, and then probably another 5 minutes later, the Chicago police were there. The Chicago police took me home to my mother, and we're standing there ringing the doorbell, and my mother opens the door, and she sees me with these 2 policemen. "What's going on?" And one of them said, "You know, your son has been a victim of a crime. Can we come in and take his statement?" And she was all flustered and so kind of didn't really want to get involved. And I said, "No, I really want to give my statement." And so they came in, and we sat down, and I went through the whole thing. I described each of the individuals who had taken the flute, and my mother said to me very sort of pessimistically and cynically, "That's the last we'll ever hear of the Chicago police." Well, it wasn't. 3 weeks later, we get a call, and they say, "We think we've apprehended the individuals who stole your son's flute. We'd like you and your son to come to the police station to do a lineup where they would put them behind glass, and then I'd have to choose between them and somebody else." My mother said, "I don't think so." And I said, no, I absolutely want to go. This is really important." And she and I struggled, and I was like really determined. I thought, you know, I'm not going to let these guys get away with it. So I overcame her hesitancy, because she really didn't want trouble with any bad guys stealing flutes or anything like that. So we drive down to the station where they had all this stuff, and they put me into the room with a bunch of young individuals, including the people who stole the flute, and I spotted them immediately. They were two of them, I think, were wearing the same clothes that they were wearing the 3 weeks before. I point them out. Police then take some notes, and then we sit there for a little while, and they come back and say to my mother, "We'd like your son to testify in court." And again, she wanted nothing to do this. She didn't want any trouble with any bad guys who were doing crimes and so on and so forth. But I was just absolutely determined that these guys weren't going to get away with it.
So you've always been a campaigner for justice, then?
Well, I mean, this is where it all started. In the end, we went to court. I testified against them. They were found guilty, and then they were let off. but this did plant the seed. Maybe I don't know if it was before that, but this planted the seed. And from then on, I was like, you know, my goal was to become a policeman. I joined the Chicago Junior Police Patrol and all sorts of other stuff, and that eventually faded away. I became a hedge fund manager. But deep down in my core, the idea of people stealing from you and getting away with it really sort of, you know, viscerally rubbed me the wrong way, and that ended up defining how I ended up as the largest foreign investor in Russia. And of course, everybody was stealing from me.
What was the attraction of Russia? Why did you end up there?
Well, you mentioned my grandfather, the communist. So he was, my grandfather, Earl Browder, was the general secretary of the American Communist Party for 13 years, ran for president twice against Roosevelt, was expelled from the Communist Party for being too much of a capitalist, and then, of course, persecuted during the McCarthy era for his, being a communist. And so this was my family legacy. And I was born in 1964. And when I was going through my teenage rebellion in the 1970s, I was trying to figure out how I could rebel from this family of communists. And I came up with this great idea, which was to put on a suit and tie and become a capitalist. And everybody in my family thought I was just like parents, my cousins, my uncles, everybody thought that like this guy is just like really—
Because they were academics.
They were all left-wing academics coming from this communist background. And it was just like the biggest, you know, insult to everybody in the family, which I really enjoyed. And I became a capitalist, and I was really good at it. And I went to Stanford Business School, and I graduated Stanford Business School in 1989, which was the year that the Berlin Wall came down. And as I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, I had this epiphany, which is that my grandfather was the biggest communist in America, and the Berlin Wall has just come down. I'm going to become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. And that's what I set out to do. And I moved to London. Had several jobs, but the job that defined my life was working at Salomon Brothers as an investment banker on their East European investment banking team. And my first assignment was to advise a fishing fleet in Murmansk on their privatization. Murmansk is a city, the furthest north population center in the world. Flew up to Murmansk to advise this fishing fleet, and the head of the fleet took me down to their the docks to see one of their boats. And a huge vessel, 400 feet long. There were the nets on the top and all sorts of things going on in the middle of the ship and the canning. They were doing canning and at the lowest level of the ship. It was like an ocean-going factory.
Amazing, yeah.
I said, how much does one of these things cost? $20 million new. How many do you have in your fleet? 100. 20 million times 100 is 2 billion. What's the age of your fleet? 7 years. I don't know much about ships for fishing, but I figure that makes it half depreciated, so $1 billion worth of ships. And I've been hired to advise the management on whether or not to exercise their legitimate right under the privatization program of Russia to purchase 51%. And I asked, what price is the government selling 51%? He said, $2.5 million.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. And I thought to myself, what am I doing advising on this stuff? I need to be investing in this stuff. Instead of coming back to London, I went to Moscow, and I didn't speak a word of Russian, and I didn't know a single Russian other than the head of the fishing fleet. And I bought an English language yellow page directory, and I had about 40 meetings over the course of the next week. And the purpose was to figure out whether this was some anomaly in the fishing industry or whether this was something more widespread. And I learned about what they call the voucher privatization program in Russia. And what they had done, they had made this fundamental decision that in order to go from communism to capitalism, they wanted to create a country full of capitalists. How are they going to do that? Well, the state owned all the property, and so they were going to give all the state property away effectively for free. And one of the ways they chose to do that was to do something called voucher privatization. And what voucher privatization was they would give a physical certificate called a voucher to each person in the country. 150 million people in the country, they gave 150 million vouchers out. And the vouchers were bearer instruments. It was like cash. You could sell it, you could buy it, you could give it, you could tear it up, you could do anything you wanted with it. And there was no restrictions on who could own them. Foreigners could own them, locals could own them. And they started trading on a secondary market. And so the vouchers traded for about $20 each. So if you did the math, $20 per voucher times 150 million gets you $3 billion worth of vouchers. And those $3 billion worth of vouchers were exchangeable for 30% of the share capital of every single Russian company, which meant that the market cap of Russia was $10 billion. And this is a country with 35% of the world's natural gas, 10% of the world's oil, 10% of the world's steel, 10% of the world's aluminum. There's fertilizer, telephone companies, car companies, banks, timber, everything. All put together, the total value was $10 billion. I mean, you couldn't buy a mid-sized oil company in Oklahoma for $10 billion, you could buy the whole country of Russia for $10 billion. And that's when I decided to quit Salomon Brothers and set up my own investment fund to invest in these privatizations. And I moved to Moscow, set up a fund called the Hermitage Fund. I raised $25 million from a famous investor named Edmund Safra, who was the owner of Republic National Bank of New York, and got to work buying up vouchers, buying into these companies. And it was the most successful launch of a of a hedge fund in the history of hedge funds. We went up 865% in the first 18 months. I went from $25 million of assets under management to more than $1 billion. And this is back in the days, and $1 billion in Russia. Remember, this is a country with a $10 billion market cap.
But by that time, it would be $100 billion.
Yeah, whatever. But point is that I was like I was bigger than, you know, I was to the Russian market bigger than Fidelity is to the U.S. market. You know,
it's extraordinary. Why do you think other people didn't spot this? I mean, it must have been very obvious to people. The Russians are really smart, right? So why did they not figure this out and think that it was a daft way of doing it?
Well, so certain Russians did. You remember these people called the Russian oligarchs?
Yes.
22 of them figured it right out, 50 times more than I did. I mean, these guys were, you know, buying majority shares of these oil companies and stuff like that. But the interesting thing was the people in the West, people are very slow to, like, catch on. And it wasn't like there was lack of information. I probably went out and pitched every single major investor in the world on investing with me in Russia. And 96% of them said no. And
so who did you mentioned in the book, you met Soros and Julian Robertson and...
Well, a lot of these people ended up giving me money, but a lot of people didn't end up giving me money. And the reason people didn't give me money was because everyone had been educated in a world where Russia was the enemy. It was the cold, for 50 years, it was the Cold War and all this nastiness.
You make it sound very obvious and almost easy, but Flemings, I worked for at this time, and Flemings were quite big in Russia. And I remember, I don't know exactly what year it was, but in the mid-90s, some guys walked into their office in Moscow and told them they were moving. And they said, no, we're not moving. They said, no, you are moving. And it was like the Wild West then, wasn't it?
And that's, of course, one of the many reasons why people didn't want to invest there, because, you know, that you could lose your money very easily.
Yes.
But here's the thing, and this is something that most people don't do as investors, which is, so there was real financial catastrophe risk investing in Russia. And so most people said, I don't want to have anything to do with it. The way I looked at it from an investment standpoint, I said, okay, there's probably a 50% chance you're going to lose everything you put into this market. That's a big number.
Sure.
But if you're buying at a 99.7% discount you don't lose your money, you could make 10, 20, 30, 40 times your money. And if it's 50-50, and who knows what the odds were, but if it was 50-50, And let's say there's a 50% chance you're going to make 10 times your money and a 50% chance you're going to lose everything, that's a pretty good deal. You don't want to put 100% of your money into that, but if you put in 1% of your money and 1% turns into 10%, that's significant. If 1% goes down to zero, that's painful, but it's not going to change your life.
That's for your investors. It was as long as they understood that was fine. But for you, that's quite a risky proposition.
Well, yeah, but I was young. I was really young. I was like 27 years old or something like that when I, you know, started doing this Russian stuff. And I moved to Moscow, I think, when I was 30. I mean, now there was two risks: career risk, financial risk, and physical risk. So the career risk I didn't care about. I could always do something else. I mean, you can reinvent yourself. The financial risk, okay, you know, I had made some money at Salomon Brothers, but again, I could lose that and that's not going to be the end of the world. And the physical risk was interesting because back in those days, there were literally people getting gunned down on the streets.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about who was getting gunned down, it was like the Russian mafia at the time was not like the Russian mafia now. The Russian mafia now, and I'll explain more later, but it's like government mafia, but the Russian mafia then was like the guys with the leather jackets and gold chains, very stupid. And so, you know, if you owned a like Rolex store on the main thoroughfare in Moscow, of course they're going to come and shake you down. But if you're some anonymous person driving a secondhand Volvo, working out of a nondescript office in an office building, trading anonymous shares, nobody's going to touch you. And nobody did. Nobody came anywhere near me. And the way I describe it, it was at the time, it was disorganized crime. And I could completely sail under the radar. But of course, it didn't work out that way.
If you enjoy this podcast, you're bound to enjoy our free newsletter on Substack. It's a weekly email on interesting investing topics. Visit behindthebalancesheet.com and hit the sign up button. While you're there, you might want to check out our brilliant online investor training school. Hundreds of students have taken our flagship Analyst Academy course, which teaches you
everything you need to become a serious equity investor. And if you're a professional investor, we run a forensic accounting course for institutional clients, and soon a cohort-based course for serious amateurs. Email us at info@behindthebalancesheet.com.
You started off, it was incredibly successful, and then with the Asian financial crisis, then long-term capital management, and then Russia defaulted, and the stock market collapsed. You were quite young. I mean, how did you cope with that? I mean, we get setbacks here, but they're not 90% setbacks.
Yeah, well, so I went from 25 million to a billion. And as I mentioned, a billion was a lot of money in Russia back then.
Sure.
And my clients were so happy with me, you couldn't have imagined. I mean, they were sending their private jets to Moscow to pick me up, to whisk me to the south of France so we could toast the success, our joint success on their yachts. And I was featured in Business Week and the Financial Times as some kind of financial genius. And I was the face of this unbelievable rise in the Russian stock market on the way up. Then, as you mentioned, the Asian financial crisis hits. And Russia had been financing, Russia had an incredibly large government debt burden in which they were paying like 50% interest. And it was rolling every 3 months. And the Asian financial crisis hit, and everyone said, well, wait a second, how can the Russians afford this? And who's going to refinance it? And the people who were funding the Russian government weren't like, you know, stable Western pension funds. They were like hedge funds and proprietary trading desks and total speculators everywhere. And one day everyone just went on a buyer's strike and said, you know, I'm not going to buy any of this Russian paper anymore. And they couldn't sell any more bonds. They had to default on their debt. They devalued the currency by 75%. And by the way, defaulting on local debt like never happened before.
It was completely unprecedented.
And my $1 billion went down 90%. I lost $900 million of my clients' money.
Well, how did that make you feel? I mean, it must have made you feel terrible.
It was pretty traumatic. It was terrible for a variety of reasons. The main reason was that I'd gone around trying to convince everybody, anyone who would talk to me, I would try to convince them to invest with me and tell them how great it was going to be. And I told them, of course, there's a 50% chance you're going to lose all your money and a 50% chance you're going to make all this money. And so the people who like had given me their confidence, I lost their money for them. And for me, that was just terrifying and mortifying and just like how horrible, what a terrible person I was to like coax them into investing and then bring on this total disaster for them. And so I was completely and absolutely determined to get their money back for them.
I must ask you, what was your mother saying at this point? I told you she never have gone to Russia.
Well, my mother was not all that highly attuned to what was going on.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
Thankfully, she wasn't sitting there seeing everything that was happening. Or either way, I think she would have been pretty upset. But I was really feeling mortified. I wasn't mortified because I lost my own money, but I was mortified that I had lost everyone else's money. And so I wanted to get their money back, and I was going to do whatever I could to get it back. And in theory, it shouldn't have been that hard to get back. And the reason for that was that I was buying shares of oil companies and gas companies, and they all sold their product in dollars to the West. They were exporters. And they all paid for their costs in rubles. And the costs had just gone down, or the ruble had just gone down by 75%, which meant that their costs had just gone down by 75%. So very simply, if you're revenues are the same and your costs have gone down, then your profits should explode.
Sure.
That's the, and by the way, in any time a country does a massive devaluation and you can invest in
exports,
it's a great thing. So that should have been the opportunity to make the money back. And I would have made the money back except for one huge caveat, which is that the people who were the majority owners of these companies were these people that we all know now as to be the Russian oligarchs. And the Russian oligarchs, these are guys who basically had used all sorts of schemes and tricks to steal these companies in the first place. And they had, up until that moment, they had been getting so many visits from really fancy bankers wearing some, and the bankers would say, hey, we love your company. This is a great company. You should be really proud of yourself for being an owner of this company. And we think we can really do some great things with you in the financial markets. We can raise money for you and all this good stuff. But you have to just completely, you know, keep your nose clean and don't scandalize your investors. And the oligarchs were thinking, you know, it'd be nice to get some of that money. we'll just hold off on scandalizing them until later. And so they had been basically sort of behaving themselves with the hope of getting some free money on Wall Street. And then the crash came, and it was really interesting. The crash, of course, affected Russia catastrophically, but it also affected a lot of banks very badly. They were all owning these bonds and so on, and you know, the Russian bonds. And so everybody pretended like they had nothing to do with Russia and any of these investment banks. And so if you were like the coverage guy on Russia, you're like, some oligarch calls you up and says, hey, can you get me some of that money now? You're saying, I'm sorry, who is this? And then put the phone down because you want to be like, you know, the guy covering Germany or whatever.
Sure.
And as a result, the oligarchs started to get the message, which is that capital markets were closed. They're not going to get any money from Wall Street. And they're figuring, okay, well, if there's no money from Wall Street coming in, there's no reason to behave ourselves anymore. And so they embarked on an orgy of stealing, which has been unprecedented in the history of business. They were doing asset stripping and transfer pricing and embezzlements and dilutions on a massive scale. And there I was sitting with my last 10 cents on the dollar. I was mortified that I had lost my client's money. I was determined to get it back, and I was going to lose the last 10 cents on the dollar. And so I decided that I was going to fight with these oligarchs to try to stop them from doing the stealing. I should point out that it's not like in America where if someone's like, you know, defrauding you, you can go to the SEC or the FTC or the, you know, DOJ or any of these other three-letter organizations. There's no regulator in Russia. There's no courts that, you know, uphold any rules in Russia. It's all sort of totally lawless. But the one thing that I did have going for me was that Russia is the most, believe it or not, the most transparent place in the world. And that sounds really completely crazy and counterintuitive. Russia is the most bureaucratic country in the world. The government collects information on everything in such minute, excruciating detail that it's almost impossible to do anything in Russia without spending almost all your life filing things. And the people who collect all this information are working in ministries where they're not being paid properly. And because there's no rules or laws in Russia, so they put the stuff up for sale. And so if I was meeting with you and we were in Russia, I could find out what your bank balance was. I could find out.
Really?
I could find out who you've called on your mobile phone. I could find out where you've traveled to. I could even get your medical records for a very small price.
Wow.
Amazing. And as a result of that transparency, we were able to then investigate who was stealing from who, how they were stealing, where the money was going. And I would create these unbelievable dossiers of stealing. And the international media was really interested in this stuff. And it's always this way where the media, you know, they don't have time to do these investigations. They're like reporting on the news on a day-to-day basis. Sure. And so I show up with a dossier on massive theft at Gazprom. And I show up with the receipts. And they're like, great, this is interesting. They would, of course, verify the information. And then they publish these stories. Now, that could have been the end of it. That could have been that, you know, we learned about the stealing, we published the stories, and then nothing happened. And except for something really strange, which was that was the moment that Vladimir Putin had just showed up on the scene. And He wasn't then the same guy he is now. And the reason he wasn't is he didn't have any power. Even though he was the president of Russia, all the power had been informally stolen by the oligarchs. They were running the country. And so when he shows up as president, the first thing he wants to do is to somehow bring the power of the position back to the presidency. And so here I was, attacking the oligarchs who were the people who he was fighting with. And there's an expression that your enemy's enemy is your friend. And I hadn't met Vladimir Putin then. I haven't met him since then. I've never had an interaction with him. But as I started to put out these scandals, it served his interests perfectly because he was fighting with the same guys. And so I would expose the management of Gazprom. What did he do? The state was the majority shareholder of Gazprom. He fired the management. I exposed the asset stripping at Unified Energy Systems. The state was the majority shareholder there. They changed the charter of the company so that they couldn't do any more asset stripping.
And presumably share prices were loving it.
Oh my God, it was unbelievable. So at the bottom of the market, I had $100 million. And as we started doing this stuff, $100 million, you know, doubled and doubled and doubled. By the time we were done, we went up 45 times. We went from 100 million to 4.5 billion.
But that must have, you got some inflows. There wasn't, was it?
Well, I mean, yeah, inflows, outflows. I mean, it was a hedge fund, so money came in and came out. But yeah, I mean, basically, if you had a unit of my fund at the bottom of the market, I think it went up 37 times or something like that.
And over what period would that have been?
1999 to 2005. So as you can imagine, I was feeling pretty good about myself.
Oh, sure.
So as bad as I felt when it went down 90%, I was feeling pretty good and proud and making money for my investors and making money for myself. And these oligarchs are really easy people to hate because they're so disgusting. These are so, so arrogant and so brutal and so not caring about anybody and anything other than themselves. Everybody in my office was just like I mean, we could have all been doing this for free and it would still be worth it. It was just so gratifying. These people were so horrible and they were doing such bad stuff. And the Russian people were suffering so dramatically because of the oligarchs. And we were getting the bad guys. And so we were making money hand over fist and doing good. And, you know, I mean, it was just the best life in the world.
But when the Yukos CEO was arrested, and I think it would be in October 2003,
yep.
That was something of a turning point, wasn't it? And that made the news here, even. It was a big, big deal. What did you think when that happened?
I thought, great, one down, 21 to go. This is it, the end of the oligarchs. The oligarch era is over, thank God. I was really a fan of Putin. I was a total supporter of taking down Horodkovsky. But then it turned out there was no next. So they arrested Horodkovsky. He was the owner of Yukos, the richest man in Russia, the largest oil company in Russia. Put him in jail for 10 years, take away his oil company. And then the next one was Roman Abramovich. Everyone knows Roman Abramovich, Chelsea football. But they didn't arrest him. They didn't take away his oil company. They gave him, I think it was $13 billion. Gazprom bought Sibneft, his oil company, for $13 billion cash, gave it to him. And instead of being arrested, they appointed him governor of a Chukotka region. And that was kind of the moment that, you know, I started to really have doubts about, you know, Putin's sincerity in this whole thing. Because that was not, you know, if Putin had gone through and like gotten rid of all the oligarchs and like brought it all back to the state and paid people wages and, you know, funded hospitals and all that kind of stuff, it would have all been good. But that wasn't his intention. His intention by arresting Horodkovsky was to send a message to the rest of the oligarchs. Not that the oligarchy is bad. It's just that he wants to be the biggest oligarch. And when Horodkovsky was sent away for 10 years, all the other oligarchs go to Putin and said, geez, what do we have to do so we don't end up going to, like, Horodkovsky to jail? And Putin said 50%. And that was the moment that Putin became the richest man in the world. And I had continued to do these naming and shaming campaigns after that. And it wasn't like there was a big announcement in the paper that they had this meeting and he was, you know, the richest man in the world. It was kind of subtle, you know, rumor mills type of stuff. But I mean, now it's proven, but back then it was not obvious. But I wasn't paying any attention to it at all. I was just like carrying on naming and shaming.
But did people know that it was you behind these press stories?
Yeah, yeah. It was absolutely clear. I was running press conferences.
Right.
It was like, you know, Bill Browder's, you know, the thing on Gazprom or on Sparebank or on whatever company it was. And so I was not hiding. And when I was doing it, by the way, I was like, you know, I had like massive security. I was like, you know, I had like 15 bodyguards and all this kind of stuff.
And what was that like? I mean, that must have been quite depressing, wasn't it? I mean,
horrible, horrible. I mean, the only time I felt safe was when I was not physically in Russia. But you know, it's one of these things where, you know, if you had asked me when I was in the middle of this thing with, like, you know, three cars, you know, with the armed men, you know, convoy going from the office to the home and, you know, scoping for snipers and bombs and stuff like that. I probably would have said, God, how did I end up in this mess? But it was all incremental. It wasn't like if I'd known before I started how I was going to end up. Which, by the way, comes back to your original question, why didn't anyone else go to Russia to do this? Because nobody else wanted to end up with armed guards and all this kind of nonsense.
And then you realized you were the frog in the boiling water when you arrived in Russia and they deported you.
So Ordakovsky was arrested in November of or October of 2003. And I was, so 2 years after that, I was then stopped at the border. I was flying back to Russia. I'd been living there 10 years and I was stopped at the border. I was arrested. I was kept in the detention center of the airport. And then I was deported and declared a threat to national security.
And that was worrying.
Well, what was more worrying was before they deported me, when I was sitting in the detention center of the airport, not knowing what was going on, I thought I was going to be sent to Siberia along with Ordakovsky. And let me tell you, you don't want to be in a Russian jail. And so they kicked me out, which was really bad for business. I mean, you're the largest foreign investor in a country. You specialize in the stock market of that country, and they don't allow you into the country. It's terrible for business, but it's hardly a very tough punishment compared to the kind of stuff they do. But I thought to myself, you know, what else could they do? I mean, so, you know, generally when they start coming after you, it's not, you know, it's not like one and done. There's a lot of stuff they want to do. And so I looked around and I said, well, I've got, you know, maybe they didn't arrest me, but I got a lot of people out there, evacuated my staff, everybody and their family members. We got everybody out.
And you must have had a lot. These were Russian nationals.
Yeah, yeah. And everyone was shocked. Their wives hated me. You know, they were just living their normal lives. Like from one day to the next, I'm organizing an emergency evacuation. They like completely leaving their lives and their family. You know, their parents and their brothers and sisters and their friends and the kids' schools and all this kind of stuff. And we had a whole evacuation thing going. Got them all out. British government was good, and we gave everybody visas to stay here. And then once we got everybody here, I said, you know, the other thing they can do is they could take away all of our money. And we had big positions in a lot of companies, but we sold billions of dollars worth of stock quietly and quickly and got all of our money out.
How did you manage that? Because it must have been very obvious that you were selling.
It wasn't clear, first of all, that I didn't like announce that I'd been kicked out because I didn't want to crash the market. And we were really clever about it. So normally, if you call up every broker, I've got $1 billion worth of Gazprom to sell this afternoon, you know, then everyone is going to front run you and all that kind of stuff. And so instead of, we picked one broker who was from a big bank, but it was not a big, but they didn't have a lot of market share. And we said, listen, we have some stock to sell. And if you can keep your mouth shut and just move the stock without like, you know, it will make your career. And this one broker rid of all of our stock quietly and properly, and nobody ever figured it out until it was all done.
That must have been the best phone call he ever had in his career, right?
Well, I mean, this happened over the course of weeks. It was not just day.
Yeah.
But he went from like, you know, being a, you know, second and a half tier broker to being the most important broker in the market.
And, yeah, imagine.
And made a lot of money for himself and his firm and got us out.
And you were able to easily repatriate the money?
We got all our money out. And people say, how's that? Why did the Russians allow you to do that? And the answer is that they're evil. We know they're evil. But they're incompetent at sort of executing their evil. I mean, the people who do this stuff, you know, there's just not a lot of planning. It's all just reactive and like sort of unprofessional. You know, these are like C students from D universities with no motivation who are running these operations. And we got all of our people out and got all of our money out successfully, and we were, you know, free and clear.
And at that point, what did you think? You think, oh, well, we'll just go and transfer to other markets? I mean, your skill at that point had been investing in Russia.
Well, so my skill was investing in Russia. We had made all of our investors a lot of money. We were able to return their money to them, you know, in a serious way. And everyone was saying, Bill Browder, what a great guy. You know, he's a smart guy. He made us money. He knows like really tough markets. And it was like this Frank Sinatra song, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. I thought, well, hell, if I could make it in Moscow, you know, how hard could it be to like invest in Brazil or Indonesia or Egypt? And so I set up, my fund, my original fund was called Hermitage Fund. I had set up Hermitage Global. And everyone came along, said, that, you know, Bill's a great guy. Well, let's give him a shot. And we started investing in other markets. And I was kicked out in November of 2005. And it was June 2007. And I should point out that the one thing I kept in Moscow was an office. I think I prepaid the lease for 2 years or something like that. And I had one secretary sitting in the office. Everyone else was gone. I'm at a board meeting for my Hermitage Global, the new fund. And I get this frantic call from the secretary in the Moscow office, who I never spoke to because, you know, my COO spoke to her regularly, but, you know, there was nothing to talk to her about. And she's calling me in hysterics. And she said, there's 25 police officers here raiding the office. And they're like drilling safes. They're pushing over a file cabinet. They were like a real, like, you know, as you'd see on TV, raiding the office. And I said, I don't know. Let me think about it. Let me figure it out. And so I call up, I have a law firm in Moscow that I use. It's an American law firm. And I call up the head of the law firm. He usually knows what to do. And he sounds distracted when I get him on the phone. I said, there's 25 officers raiding my office. What should I do? He said, there's 25 officers raiding my office right now looking for your documents. I don't know. Let me get back to you. So 50 police officers raiding his office and my office. And they were specifically looking for the stamps, seals, and certificates for our Russian investment holding companies through which we had invested our money in Russia. And they found them at the law firm's office. They grabbed them and took them away. I was trying to figure out what was going on here. And I just had this feeling that if something really bad is going to happen here. I don't know what it is. Our money is safe, our people are safe, but I don't want to be walking through Frankfurt Airport, you know, one day and getting arrested on a Russian Interpol notice. And so there was no financial motivation, but there was sort of legal sort of protection motivation. And so I went out and I hired the smartest lawyer I knew in Russia, a guy named Sergei Magnitsky. At the time, he was 35 years old. He was a tax lawyer, and he specialized in all this sort of company formation stuff. And he knew his way around things. He could run circles around everybody else. And I said to Sergei, I need you to figure out what's going on here. And he started to investigate, and he figured out that we no longer owned our companies anymore. The companies, which were empty, had been fraudulently re-registered using the documents seized by the police. And in a nutshell, he had figured out that there were two parts of the scam. The first was they wanted to steal all of our money, but we had gotten our money out before they could steal it. But the one thing that they did succeed in doing, which was that when we sold everything, when we had that broker selling everything for us, at the end of the sale process, we had a huge profit, crystallized the profit, and we paid to the Russian government $230 million of capital gains tax. And what Sergei Magnitsky, our lawyer, had discovered was that the people who stole our companies had taken those companies back to the tax authorities, and they said there was actually no profit. These companies didn't earn $1 billion. They earned zero. And therefore, the companies that paid $230 million of taxes paid those taxes in error. And they said, we'd like that money back. So they applied for a $230 million illegal tax refund on the 23rd of December, 2007, 2 days before Christmas, and was approved and paid out the next day.
As these things, obviously, with a really efficient bureaucracy would be done. Yeah.
Right. If I had legitimately overpaid $5,000 in 2007, I'd still be chasing it today. But yeah. $230 million, which, by the way, was the largest tax refund in the history of Russia, paid in one day. Sergei and I were convinced this must be some type of scam because Putin is a, this is not our money. This was the Russian government's money that was stolen. And we were convinced that if the guys who ran the country understood that their officials were stealing $250 million from them, then that would be the end of that scam. And so we wrote criminal complaints to every different law enforcement agency in Russia, to the head of every law enforcement agency in Russia. I went on to the newspapers, radio, television to tell the story. And Sergei gave sworn testimony to the Russian State Investigative Committee, which is their version of the FBI. And then we sat back and we waited for the good guys to get the bad guys. Well, as I said, there's no good guys. And instead of arresting the people who conducted the fraud, the people who conducted the fraud arrested Sergei Magnitsky On the 24th of November, he was arrested at his home. 24th of November, 2008. Arrested at his home. He was put in pretrial detention. And then he was tortured in pretrial detention to retract his testimony. They put him in cells with 14 inmates and 8 beds and left the lights on 24 hours a day to impose sleep deprivation. They put him in cells with no heat and no window panes in December in Moscow, so he nearly froze to death. They put him in cells with no toilet, just a hole in the floor where the sewage would bubble up. They'd move him from cell to cell to cell in the middle of the night. So they wanted him to retract his testimony, but they also wanted him to sign a false confession to say that he stole the $230 million and he did so on my instruction. And they figure, here's a guy, you know, he's wearing a blue suit and a red tie and he buys Starbucks in the morning and he sits in a fancy Western law firm a week of this and he'll buckle and sign whatever they want him to sign. But he wasn't like that. He was a man of incredible integrity, and for him the idea of perjuring himself and bearing false witness was more awful than the physical pain they were subjecting him to, and he refused. And after about 6 months of this, his health started to break down. He developed terrible pains in his stomach. He lost 20 kilos. He was diagnosed as having pancreatitis and gallstones and needing an operation, which was scheduled for the 1st of August, 2009. A week before the operation, they come to him again ask him to sign a false confession. Again, he refuses. And in retaliation, they abruptly move him from prison that had a medical wing to a maximum security prison called Butyrka, which is considered to be one of the most awful prisons in Russia. At Butyrka, his health completely breaks down. He and his lawyers write 20 different desperate requests for medical attention. Every one of those requests was either ignored or denied. And on the night of November 16, 2009, Sergei went into critical condition. And on that night, the Butyrka authorities didn't want to have responsibility for him anymore. And they put him in an ambulance and sent him across town to a different prison. But instead of putting him in the emergency room, they put him in an isolation cell. They chained him to a bed, and 8 riot guards with rubber batons beat him until he died. He was 37 years old. He left a wife and 2 children. That was November 16th, 2009. I got the news the next morning, and it was the most horrifying, life-changing, traumatic news I could have ever gotten. He was basically killed because he worked for me. If he hadn't been working for me, he'd still be alive. And when I was finally able to wade through the fog of heartbreak and hysteria to think clearly, I made a vow that I was going to put aside my life as a businessman, as a financier, and I was going to devote all of my time, all of my energy and all of my resources to go after the people who killed him to make sure they face justice.
It's a shocking story, obviously. Is there anything you would have done differently? I mean, you sound like you bear some guilt for this, but it seems to me that there's nothing that any reasonable person would have done differently.
Well, there's a lot of things I could have done differently. I mean, I asked him to leave the country. I had other lawyers. He wasn't the only lawyer. And when it became clear that it was unsafe for our lawyers after we had filed these criminal complaints, I asked them all to leave. 2 of them did. And they sit in my office to this day. But he pleaded with me. He said, you know, I've not done anything wrong. This is not 1937, which was the height of the Stalin purges. He said that this is not where we are right now. And I could have emphatically pushed him. I mean, would it have changed his mind? I don't know, but I could have done that differently. But generally, I mean, you know, everything else, I don't know what I could have done differently. I mean, what I could have done differently is not gone to Russia in the first place. People ask me, what would you have done differently? If I had stayed in California after Stanford, I probably would have made more money, not had any dead people. I mean, having said that, I wouldn't have met my wife. I wouldn't have had my children. But, you know,
you can live a different life.
It's absurd to even think that. But the answer is that, you know, at every step of the way, I was kind of faced with choices, and I chose what I thought was the right choice. I mean,
So you've made the moral choice all along. Well, I just wonder, I mean, how is your life affected now, leaving aside the emotional issues, the safety of yourself and your family? I mean, when I met you, you were speaking at a conference, and when I wanted to go to talk to you, a bodyguard wouldn't let me. I mean, it sounds to me that this is an awful way to live.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of like Ukraine. You know, they didn't start the war. Russia did.
Sure.
It's an awful way to live, not knowing if you're going to, you know, die in the night from an airstrike. But, you know, I didn't choose this war. They chose it. I'm at war with them. And you know, we haven't gotten into what I've done, you know, for Sergei, but, you know, I've made sure that Putin and his people paid a dear price for what they did to Sergei. There's now legislation called the Magnitsky Act, which freezes the assets and bans the visas of human rights violators who killed Sergei Magnitsky and do similar types of crimes. And the Magnitsky Act now exists in 35 countries. And off the back of the Magnitsky Act, thousands of Russians have been sanctioned for what they've done. And so I they've paid a dear price, and they're very, very mad at me. And they're chasing me around the world with death threats, with kidnapping threats, with Interpol arrest warrants, with all sorts of nastiness. And how do I feel about it? You know, you this is my life. You know, it's not like it's not like you can say, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. It is what it is. I mean, you know, they declared war on me. And so this is my war, and I'm fighting it. And so far I've survived it. 14 years into it, I've survived it.
What made you write the book? Was it to get attention to the whole issue?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that everybody knows the story of what, you know, at the time, there was in London here in particular, all these awful people were just like kissing Russians' asses, wanting to do business with them, wanting to have their money, not like ignoring all these terrible things that are happening. And I wanted the world to know who these people were. And both books have been thankfully very, very widespread and successful and well-read. And I think the books have actually changed the perception of Putin in Russia. And I mean, the reaction and the, you know, politicians all over the world, financiers all over the world, you know, captains of industry have read this book. And the consistent, regular reaction is, I knew Russia was bad, but I had no idea it was that bad.
The books are amazing. And I mean, you write brilliantly. And it's one of these things where the facts are stranger than fiction. Often you get that with these sorts of stories, but the stories are absolutely exceptional, and they're incredibly well written. I wondered what you make of the situation now, because you obviously look at the world through a rather different lens from most people, and perhaps we can talk about the tragic situation in Ukraine. It seems to me that Russia has won a lot of long, grinding, drawn-out wars. Is this going to be any different?
I don't think Russia is going to win this war. But Putin, so the latest statistics are that Putin has lost 85% of the troops he started out with when he launched this war. That's more than 300,000. And that doesn't mention, and that doesn't include, by the way, the convicts working for the Wagner Group and all. I mean, the equipment that's been destroyed. You know, Russia has been truly. I mean, and that's just on the military side. We haven't talked about the economic side. You know, they've lost their most important customer for their most important export industry, gas, natural gas, forever. I don't think anyone's going to. In Europe is going to hook themselves up to the pipeline in Russia. Everyone's going to find alternative sources.
Sure.
And that most important customer is responsible for the most important contribution to their government budget. They've lost a million of the most capable young men who don't want to be cannon fodder in the war, and they've all left because they've left for other countries, the programmers and accountants and marketing people and all this kind of stuff. It's a total, absolute disaster what Putin has done to his own country, what he's doing to Ukraine, of course. Now, what's going to happen in this war, I don't know. I mean, at the moment, Putin is ready to, like, he's ready to suck up his gut and take these hits in ways that we couldn't have even ever imagined.
Well, he doesn't have a choice. I mean, from sitting in his shoes, it's not like he can retire.
No,
he's
he can't,
a dead man.
Right? He can't retire, and I believe he started this war specifically for that reason. But
yes.
But I think he completely misjudged how it was going to go. I don't think I don't think he ever imagined that this was going to happen the way it happened.
But do you think our response has been the right response? Obviously, sanctioning individuals has been very effective. But the idea that you could somehow block Russian oil or impose a price cap on Russian oil seems a bit daft to me. I mean, what America should have been doing was encouraging the production of more oil and putting pressure on the Saudis to pump more and crater the economy even more, surely.
Well, there's a lot of stuff we could have done differently. I mean, first of all, I'm very involved in all this stuff, and I've been present at meetings with, you know, the decision makers in U.S. and other places. And we didn't want to have the Ukrainians win the war. We wanted the Ukrainians not to lose the war, but we didn't want the Ukrainians to win the war. And I say we. I want the Ukrainians to win the war.
Yes.
I'm desperate for the Ukrainians to win the war. But Jake Sullivan, the President Biden's national security advisor, said explicitly at the Aspen Security Forum that he's afraid of escalation.
Yes.
And so we've been closely calibrating, just giving them enough so that the Russians don't succeed, but not because they're scared of what's Putin going to do if he's defeated. Is he going to start a nuclear war? I don't think so, but that's what they're afraid of.
Yes.
And so now we're in this terrible place where we've kind of forced the Ukrainians to tie one hand behind their back in fighting. And all of a sudden, Biden no longer controls the narrative because the Republicans, the right-wing Republicans in America, are trying to withhold funding for the war. And Biden can decide to do whatever he wants to do, but he doesn't control the budget.
Yeah.
Congress controls the budget in America. And they're not, and at the moment, and I think that I can't imagine that Ukraine's not going to get the money that they need, some money they need from America in the future. I think it's going to come. But what it signals to me is that, and by the way, Trump is, you know, if you look at the bookmakers, they're saying he's got the best odds of becoming the next president of the United States, and he'll cut off Ukraine completely. And so we're in this terrible situation where I don't think that Putin can win the war. I mean, it could drag on in really awful ways, and the number of dead people is going to go up, and it'll be, you know, it's like the Vietnam War was a 20-year war.
Yeah.
The Iran-Iraq War was an 8-year war. It's just horrible. It's just horrible. And by the way, if Putin does win, if he were to win this war, he doesn't stop at Ukraine.
Well, he needs a new enemy.
He always needs an enemy. And so he'll go after Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania. And then what do we do? Do we go to, you know, are we going to have the fortitude to like honor our NATO treaty obligations and go to war with Russia? Or are we going to, which is catastrophic if we do and catastrophic if we don't?
No, it's a terrible, terrible problem. But it seems to be a lot of issues in the world now that seem insoluble. Same thing in the Middle East. I was struck reading Freezing Order. The back, you've got pages and pages of acknowledgements, hundreds and hundreds of people. Just tell us what's it like doing your job, and what's your day look like? I was amazed because you've got hundreds of politicians in I think I counted 30 countries. I might have been more. Well, how do you spend your time?
Well, I'm a full-time justice warrior. I'm out there fighting for justice for Sergei Magnitsky first and foremost, but not just for Sergei, for other victims in Russia, and not just in Russia, but in other countries. You know, what started as a campaign for one person has led to a global movement. The Magnitsky Act is now in 35 countries. It applies globally to Chinese human rights violators and Saudi human rights violators and Iranian human rights violators, et cetera. And victims come to me like with their stories, and I can't really turn them away. And so I've got different cases and different people wrongly imprisoned, and there's different atrocities that have been committed where people have been untouchable and need to be touched, and it becomes a full-time thing. But I'm very, I have created, the one thing I've discovered there's a lot of bad people in the world, but if you look at the back of my book and you see that acknowledgement section, there's a lot of really good people in the world, in a lot of different places, who went into politics for the right reasons. When you talk about politicians, I found some real heroes. And sometimes people are heroic in one area and terrible in another area, but I found some real heroes. I'm currently working. One of my closest friends is who's in freezing order, who helped me get the Magnitsky Act passed in different countries. His name is Vladimir Karamurza. He went back to Russia after the war started. He's a British national. He's a Russian national, an opposition politician, and a great man. He protested the war, and he's now in jail in Siberia, in solitary confinement, serving 25 years. And I was just in Parliament yesterday with his mother, and we got the most warmest reception in Parliament from the most important members of Parliament, cross-party, ready to do whatever they could to help him, help his family, help me, help him. And those people were all, you know, people who helped on the Magnitsky Act, and we got to know and you can, you know, you can kind of identify the good ones, and there's a lot of them that I've identified in different here and elsewhere.
Well, I think that's a really lovely, slightly uplifting note and a very sad story to end it at. I just want to say thank you enormously for doing this. It has been fascinating talking to you. And we normally ask people to recommend a book, but I'm not going to ask you to do that, because you've written two fantastic books that I know that people who haven't read them will really enjoy. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill's story of Sergei Magnitsky's arrest, torture, and murder was harrowing in the book. It was awful, but sitting with Bill in the room while he told the story was a really grim experience. He must have told that story 1,000 times, but he is still highly emotional. I found it tough to sit through, and afterwards, I just didn't have a question. And when I asked them, would he have done anything differently? What I meant was, you could not have done anything differently. This was something that happened through no fault of Bill Browder. But Bill feels a tremendous responsibility. I think he would do anything to be able to rerun his life differently, like in Sliding Doors. And this is shocking, really, as Browder has dedicated his life trying to prevent a reoccurrence of that death. And I have enormous respect for the man. Perhaps it's a function of age that as you get older, you value integrity more highly. To me, Bill Browder is a hero. Here's a man that was a dunce of his family, yet he's had three careers with success at the highest level. He not only had the best performing hedge fund in the world, one, then a second best-selling book, and he has generated legislation in over 30 countries to sanction thugs and crooks. What an astonishing set of achievements. And irrespective of Magnitsky's tragic and untimely death, the world is a better place because of Bill Browder. I'm incredibly grateful to Bill for agreeing to come on, to Risha for arranging it, and to you for listening. Without this podcast, I wouldn't have the opportunity to spend time with my heroes. You can follow Bill on Twitter at Bill Browder, and we've posted details of the Magnitsky Justice Foundation on the webpage at behindthebalancesheet.com/podcasts. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe or follow, and please leave a review or at least a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Let's spread the word so I can get more guests like Bill. Thank you.